1945 U.S. Air Force Base in Tinian Island, a general tells the men they're going to go firebomb Tokyo. The protagonist is Muldrow. He tapes a knife to his chest and modifies a parachute. A big guy and a little guy come up to him. They intimidate him. He takes the little guy under his wing after a pull-up contest. They go on an airplane, start bombing Tokyo. He blows up other airplanes. Their airplane gets hit. He jumps out the door with a parachute, is flying down towards Tokyo. We go into a flashback of him. He gets stuck in the snow with these dogs. He loses his mittens. He kills one of the dogs and puts his hand inside the dog to thaw his hands. He gets his fingers working again. And then he's sitting by the fire.
That's great. This is To the White Sea, episode 12.
Pages 23 and 24.
We got a transition sent in from friend of the show, Melissa. Let's go bowling. Dawn, close on harness, mended. Muldrow, he stands in the churned up snow behind the sled. Beyond him, his fire still crackles. He is sinking a rod here and there into the snow. Minutes later, Muldrow stands at the top of the hillock that is between the sled and where he killed the dog. He is pulling on his mittens, looking. A wolf from a pack of three looks up from the carcass of the dog. The other two continue to root in the carcass. The sled dog's head waggles with the activity of the feeding beasts. Later, still day, Muldrow pulls the sled up before an isolated cabin. It is in a clearing, the far end of which ends in a vertical drop. Beyond it is sea. Smoke rises from the cabin's chimney. Interior cabin. As Muldrow enters, a man in his 40s who sits before the fireplace does not react. He is mending something with needle and thread. Muldrow pulls off his gloves. His hands are still red and swollen. He wordlessly pulls a chair around to face the fire. He sits to warm his hands. His father glances over, sees the boy's hands. He goes back to his sewing. Muldrow gazes into the fire. Its flames lap at the wood. Muldrow stares. Distant fires. Fires in the night rush up toward us from the burning docks. Our perspective wrenches and twists. Muldrow grunts as his descent is brought up short. He twists in the harness of his parachute. He looks down. Twisting below, far below, is the black sparkle of water. It is bordered by gray pavement. Dock. The line between solid dock and tossing water rotates slowly with our twisting perspective. Muldrow looks up. The view up is equally dizzying. The lines from his chute are surrounding radial lines that twist. They reach up to meet the dull white of the underside of his chute. The parachute is snagged in a projecting piece of trusswork far above. Muldrow looks around. He is suspended from the gantry of a crane at the docks of Tokyo Harbor. Very present is the creak of his twisting gear. Less present is the lap of water below.
To the white sea, to the white sea. Of all the things I'd like to see, to the white sea is the one I cannot.
He's hanging like a puppet on a string.
Seriously.
He's hanging like he's in the Thunderdome.
He's hanging like so many Coen's characters have hung in Coen's past and future of when this would have been made.
Talk about characters on strings.
Yeah. Well, the first thing I think of is Lewin singing Hang Me, Oh Hang Me. Yeah. A lot of hanging imagery in Oh Brother.
You're talking about literally like hanging someone like as an execution style hanging.
Yeah. There's a scene in True Grit where she has to cut down the guy who's hanging. Maddie has to clamber up a tree and cut a guy down, a dead guy. So tell me some non-noose hanging scenes.
Well, I can't think of one right now. Mm. There's no scenes of people rappelling or hanging from parachutes. Oh, I can think of one. Scarlett Johansson in Hail Caesar, when they pull her up out of the pool directly towards the camera. What made me think of that is the part where they're talking about the radial lines, the POV shot looking up at the parachute, which made me think of that shot where there's similarly the ropes that are pulling her up go like directly into the center of the screen.
Well, there's also the scene in True Grit where they pull Maddie up from the cave, because LaBeouf builds that pulley system, which we talked about Sure, there's others.
They're very interested in POV shots. That's what I picked up from these pages. It's really, as he's falling, you find out the information largely from just seeing black sparkle of water, but not really seeing a transition into it. And then Muldrow looks up. Then you see something confusing. Then it's Muldrow looks around. Then you see another thing that's confusing. And you're getting the imagery before you're getting the context. And that's how, I mean, the fact that he's hanging from a dock crane above the water is revealed like a punchline, because it all comes through mostly through POV shots intercut with his reaction shots.
Yeah, it's a punchline for sure. It's like, it's a little bit of when you see something you can barely see in terms of like the sensory experience.
When you see something you can barely see is so rooted in POV.
Right.
And information that you have and information right. you don't have.
There was also a scene a few pages ago when the plane was spinning, like a very similar sort of, not sure if it was exactly a POV shot, but just the feeling of like we go from sky to water to sky to water as someone's twisting and spinning.
Yeah, twice on this page they use the word twisting perspective or perspective wrenches and twists.
There's a lot of spinning in Coen's movies.
Dutch angles that don't hold one angle, but are moving as the shot's action is happening.
Yeah. And then so at the beginning of this scene, we just get a little, I don't want to say a relief, but maybe a little bit, you know, a cut to amended, not already finished on the harness. We see that he's fixed the harness. We see that a wolf is, a pack of three wolves is nosing the carcass of the dog he killed. So that's nice.
It's nice.
It's a circle of life.
Well, it's like the tension, the unbearable tension of the flashback was resolved at the end of the pages last week.
Right.
He was sitting by the fire, and so he's safe. He's out of danger. This is kind of the fallout. He now has a strategy. He's come up with a process for finding where the mittens are by using a stick. He's had a little time to think, and I guess basically the idea is now he's warmed up, so he can just stick enough holes in the ground until he can feel the difference between snow and the mittens. A little bit like Tom Waits in All Gold Canyon.
Yeah.
It's like you can find it eventually. You just need to kind of survey the land.
Right.
And you need a methodical process.
Yeah.
And a tool.
Yeah, like the poles out of a tent maybe, too, in No Country.
Wow, really?
Plunge in the depths here.
Our brains are becoming like spider webs.
Exactly.
All these things are like one problem has to be solved before the other problem. So the problem of the harness getting broken, then turned into the mittens getting lost, then turned into like I have to figure out how to kill this dog even though it doesn't want to die. And now he's kind of pulling his way, like the problems were stacking up on top of each other.
Yeah.
And now he's kind of like closing up one, getting ready to do the other. And yeah, a bunch of wolves, you know, it's like just not only is it a cold place, but it's a place filled with predators, because that's not his dog. Those are just wild animals.
Yeah, those are wolves eating the dog.
Yeah.
I'm curious what happened to the rest of the team, because he drags the sled to a cabin. So I wonder if he like just let them run off or well, maybe actually, you know what? I think when it says Muldrow, let me correct that. I think when he says Muldrow pulls the sled up before an isolated cabin, I think they're writing it. Like in terms of like if it was a car.
Oh, yeah.
So he's got the dogs with him when it says he pulls them up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So that is a correction. Duly noted.
How about the description of where the cabin is?
It's in a clearing, the far end of which ends in a vertical drop. Beyond it is sea.
This is his dad's house. Remember we read in the book, his dad was from Virginia and was just like, we don't know why he decided to go to this place, but it's as far as you could possibly be.
Yeah.
Like if you ever wanted to sit far away from someone, like on the subway, this is the biggest example. Yeah.
This is
of that inclination. It's just like, I want to sit as far away from everyone else as I possibly can before I'm in the North Pole.
Yeah. It is interesting that his dad fulfilled this incredible escapist fantasy. Like it's not like his dad was born there and his dad was born there. Like his dad was born in Virginia and was like, I need to get away. And he did it.
Yeah.
Was Muldrow's mom in the picture in the novel at all? Was it just his dad?
I don't remember. I could look that up, but right. I don't remember anything about his mom.
So we've kind of done the end of the scene when we flash back or flash forward, and we've done the beginning of the scene. But the middle is quite striking. When Muldrow goes inside, we meet his father, a man in his 40s. Muldrow pulls off his gloves. His hands are still pretty messed up. He wordlessly pulls up a chair, warms his hands. His father glances over, sees the hands, goes back to his sewing. The father's been sitting in a chair sewing. Muldrow looks into the fire and just stares at the fire.
He gets no reaction from his father.
Nothing. I think it's interesting that Muldrow had that line beginning of the script where he said, you might have a few bone fragments left after you shake my hand. I could use those to sew with. And in that scene, he just sort of, he took the idea of sewing and made it like hyper masculine. And then we kind of pick up that thread, no pun intended, with the dad sitting there sewing, and you kind of see sewing as this survival technique, or just a thing you have to do when you live that far out.
Well, no one has to use bone fragments to sew. I mean,
you could. I guess you could. But yeah.
It's so gnarly.
Yeah.
We're only on page 23, and sewing is strongly being linked with like hyper intense self-reliance, ability to take care of yourself, I would say, is like the dad is there sewing by the fire.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting thing. I mean, you could have him like cleaning a gun.
Yeah.
You know, you could have him, what else? Like
cleaning an animal, like, like pulling,
dressing an animal, basically.
Yeah.
That would also be pretty macho. Yeah. Those are two pretty violent things, hunting related. But sewing is an important thing to do if you want to, you know, take care of yourself.
And it relates also to Muldrow's advice about watching the planes slide down a string.
Just thread and string.
Yeah.
Being threaded.
It's already a robust motif.
But why won't he? This has been so exciting. It's been so tension filled. We see that he almost died, and he probably has like frostbite. There's probably like real like broken blood vessels, and I mean his hands are not just red. They're action movie fucked up, right? And the dad sees his son is injured and has no reaction.
Gives no reaction. Nothing. Goes back to his sewing.
Doesn't seem to care. Certainly doesn't reach out to make an emotional connection or even to ask what happened.
Bad dad.
Bad dad.
Seriously.
What would a good dad do?
I mean, probably be like, where were you, son? I was worried about you. I need to make you feel bad about this. No, you're like, no. No, you'd probably be like... Yeah, he'd probably be like, I'm glad you made it back. Let me make some kind of a poultice. let's take care of those fingers.
You know, like make some pesto that you could put on the fingers. Yeah, that make him feel better.
Let's look at this.
Yeah.
Looks like he had quite a night out in the snowy tundra.
Cause it was an overnight, right? He had to. Okay.
For sure.
So yeah.
Glad you're okay. Let's look at those fingers. And next time, don't ever drop your mittens. I made you this strap with my sewing needle that you can connect your mittens to your...
Oh, he gets little clippies.
Yeah, he gives them clippies. Yeah, that would be good, Dad. Should we move on to the prism? I feel like this is a great teeing up of today's theme.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a great organic segue.
Cue the accordion. Today's prism is distant father figures. Because when I read this scene, my first reaction was, I've seen this before. This is a scene in miniature that resembles other interactions in their films between a father and a son, or a father figure and a son figure in some sense. Today, I would like to explore those character dynamics. And I think in a lot of ways, it's going to be sort of a spiritual sequel to last week's episode, because a lot of these father figures are unforgivable characters. Some of them might even be the protagonists. You always ask me, Ray, like, what should you be looking for when you're watching the clips that I chose? And I think that what I said was, how does the father figure feel about his son? How apparent is how he feels? to the sun or not apparent? Because sometimes it's really not clear. And then how does the sun react? How does the sun respond? And I think in answering that question, we'll make some headway.
Hun?
Hi, hun. Welcome back. How is Fargo?
Yeah, real good.
Dad's here.
How you doing, Wade?
Yeah, pretty good.
What you watching there?
Gophers.
Who they playing?
Ray, I'm so excited to go deep on Fargo because we have a little like chart matrix of Coen's movies that we've covered. And surprisingly, despite the fact that Fargo is kind of like their text and one or two most well-known movies and most well-regarded movies, we really haven't gone that deep on Fargo, which is exciting, I think.
This is one of their most transporting movies. Something about when you watch their other films and then you fall into a clip from Fargo, there's something so gripping about it, just the level of realism versus style that it has and the tone that all the actors are playing, where there's definitely performances that are heightened and there's visuals that are absurd. The clothes are strange and there's a lot to look at. It's not a bland movie, but it's so, there's something real about these characters that really, I mean, I would say similarly to No Country for Old Men, there's some balance that they hit in this between like enough Coen stuff to keep it really, really surprising moment to moment and really a lot to savor. But there's also, there's a fundamental integrity to the reality of the characters that just makes it like, it pulls you right in whatever scene you turn to. Almost everything that happens feels understated and iconic at the same time.
Very much so. I mean, if you compare this to their previous movies, like working backwards, like Hudsucker, Barton Fink, Miller's Crossing, Raising Arizona, Blood Simple, I think the only one that comes close in terms of just simulating reality, like I feel like I'm really in a room with real people. I'm in an office, I'm across the desk, I'm at a restaurant. It feels like a place that I've been to or could go to. I mean, other than Blood Simple, Fargo is just hitting those marks.
Yeah, I'm also really hung up ever since we started doing the show. I did more research on the production of this film, and it's like they had a nightmare production. Do you know the nightmare?
I do not.
It was so warm when they shot this. It was like a freakishly warm spell, and there's just no snow in this movie. The feeling of wall-to-wall snow that's created is largely an illusion. And if you look in, like, let's say even the background of the scene where William H. Macy is talking to Stan Grossman and his dad, his father-in-law. There's like snow on the bottom of the window. And then if you look out back, it's like totally, there's no snow in the deep background.
That is so fascinating. That on top of everything else, you look at this movie and you're like, well, that's how they solved the problem of scaling down, is they went to this icy place and they just shot it for what it was. So to hear that production designer had to create that, well, that's amazing.
It's a low budget movie. It really is.
So we're focusing on Jerry Lundegaard.
Yeah.
And we're focusing on his relationship with his family. And the way that his father-in-law kind of performs the function of a father figure in a lot of scenes. And then Jerry tries to in other scenes, and the interplay between these characters. So first scene I chose is right after the sequence we talked about in, I think it was episode 4 setup. We talked about him meeting the two hired kidnappers, and then he comes home in Minneapolis to dinner. It's nighttime. His father-in-law's watching a game. What I love about this scene is Wade, the father-in-law, just the guttural sounds that he makes when he's watching the game. He's way more invested in the game than he is in talking to his son-in-law. So similar to the scene we read at the top of the show.
Oh yeah, it's, you come in and he's ignoring you, and I think it's really when he does that, like, very guttural. It's like, to me, it feels like he wants to growl at Jerry when the moment Jerry walks in, but he's using sports as a cloak to be disconnected, have his attention, to tell everyone, like, I'm focused on this. I don't know. It's like a dog. Okay. Isn't the interpersonal reaction? Jerry walks up to him with these very soft sounds, like William H. Macy's, very sing-songy, very kind of like soft energy. And this guy's just like, isn't that the scene?
Yeah.
The sports is just a pretense for doing that.
Yeah.
The deal with the McDonald's, which is not written that way. Some of the son's dialogue is written like phonetically. Call it phonetically?
Yeah.
What is that? Yeah. You know how we talked about this with the certain characters like Melmet, Luigi, and Cy Abelman get phonetic spelling. McDonald's is not spelled phonetically, but the McDonald's conversation is just an indicator of this guy is a disciplinarian. He's a real hard ass. He has a different idea about how tough and how distrustful to be about Scotty. Scotty seems like a perfectly nice kid. There's no reason to be suspicious of him.
If he's going to McDonald's, I think they are drinking milkshakes.
He's just spraying this little kid in a sweater down with hostility for no reason, so that when William H. Macy starts to be like, hey, what about that conversation we were having about the parking lot? You're just like, oh, God. Like,
what do you think about this deal? I'm asking you. Stan Grossman's going to say no. That's his job. That's why I'm talking to you. This could be a good deal for Gene and Scotty. And then... his dad says, Gene and Scotty don't have anything to worry about.
Well, that's where you would break up the scene in terms of like the scene's about one thing and then it's about another.
Yeah.
You know? Scotty leaves and he's like, did you have a chance to think about it? And he goes, we'll talk to Stan. He says, I lost a bunch of money back in the 50s on parking lots. He says, I thought you were going to show it to Stan Grossman. That's the proper thing. He's the gatekeeper. And he goes, I know he's the gatekeeper, but he's a gatekeeper there to keep me out. I would say that's where William H. Macy changes the dynamic of the conversation by saying, I'm asking you directly because I know if I went through it normally, I would get a no, which is quite bold, actually.
Yeah, he steps up. You see where this character has a little bit, like just a tiny bit of juice, is like being able to be direct when it comes to working an angle on a loan or a business connection.
Right. And it really clarifies the issue, because then he says, like, the motivation for this is for my family, the three of us. At which point Wade says, Gene and Scotty never have to worry. And the way he looks away and drinks the coffee, it's some of the most ice cold, like, film noir. Like, it's really pulpy. And it really is like what the whole film hinges on, in a way, is this like problem between William H. Macy and his father-in-law. Is that like his father-in-law does not see him as like a part of his concern.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is the kind of thing where if you watch the previous scene, you're like, this is just about how repressed Jerry is. And then you see the next scene and you're like, no, there is actually like a structural blockage. I'm not trying to give this guy much credit, but it is quite clear that he could not get this money if he came clean. I don't know what would happen. I mean, it'd be interesting to find out what would happen. But he has good reason to be like, I can't let them know that I'm this deep in debt.
I mean, this is really similar to the White Sea scene, where it's like someone's in trouble and I just don't care. You know? Like,
couldn't be bothered.
Couldn't be bothered to know, to think of myself as somehow intertwined with this other person. Just their problem is their problem. Their suffering is their suffering.
Yeah. My daughter and my grandson, they're important to me, and you are not.
Yeah.
Very bad. Very bad quasi-parenting style.
What would a good father-in-law do in a moment like that?
Probably say, sounds like you're in trouble. I don't know. Good father-in-law. God, I've never been a father-in-law. I have no way to relate to that, you know?
Do you think Jerry has a family?
It's a really good question. Is it ever mentioned in the screenplay, like what his side of the family is like?
I don't remember anything like that.
Yeah. Do you think he's upwardly mobile? Like, do you think he's a guy who met Jean and married her partly for the money?
I don't think his parents have as much money as Jean's, as Wade does at all.
Yeah. So that's interesting.
Feeling the tension, the pressure. A lot of these scenes to me seem like you're watching William H. Macy trying to mimic other people and basically just trying to do what he thinks. He's always just being like,
no, I think that's super interesting. Like, and one scene that I did just want to point out that was not in our selection, but is super important, is just when he says, is after the kidnapping. You hear him say, Wade, it's Gene. It's Gene. And then you kind of, the camera like sort of pans up. I can't remember the exact movie.
Right.
Basically, there's a reveal that he's not on the phone. He's rehearsing. He says it a few different ways. He tries it a little bit more blubbery. He tries it a little bit more. He's an actor. He's revealed to be a performer.
Yeah. Yeah. And you've been seeing through the seams of it the entire time. He's putting on these different masks and these different affects.
Yeah.
To try to basically like meet everyone at where he thinks their energy is. But
the lost sheep.
Well, did you think he's an orphan?
That's a good question. Could be. Could be.
I'm talking about your potential. Mm-hmm. You're not a C student.
Yeah.
Yet you're getting C grades. It's that disparity there that concerns your dad and me.
Uh-huh.
You know what a disparity is?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's why we don't want you going out for hockey.
Oh, man. Come on, what's the big deal? It's just an hour.
Hold on.
What's the big deal?
Hello?
Yeah, hi, hon.
Oh, hi, Dad.
Jerry around.
Yeah, hon. Yeah, he's here. Yeah, I'll catch him for you, hon.
Get him.
Yeah.
It's Dad. Yeah,
okay.
Look, Dad, there's no fucking way
that... Scotty.
Hey, let's watch that language there.
And then the phone rings. It's Wade. And William H. Macy enters. So he's just been out of frame. He's been sitting in the living room while his wife delivers this hugely disappointing news to their son. I mean, that stuff matters a lot. And he just was in the other room, kind of waiting for her to deliver the news. He runs in when he gets a phone call from Wade saying, yeah, this sounds pretty sweet. And I just also like want to point out the angles of this script, which is that the guy's already hired the two guys to kidnap his wife. And he's still trying to get himself out of the situation in a different way. Like he can't even, like he's always hedging. Like the idea that like a big part of his like the tension is that he wants to get back in touch with Shep to be like, I thought it was going to go one way, but now it's going another way. So I don't actually need their help. You would think he would have exhausted all options before deciding to like he's so disorganized. I don't know. I just think that's interesting that this character has these overlapping plans.
He's so happy at the end of the scene. When he gets this news, it's just the happiest I think he is in the entire film. He really feels at peace, and you get this impression that he feels like the trouble is over and he's entering into a mellow part of his life.
He thinks that he can call this off.
Yeah.
And he for sure can't.
Yeah.
His wife's still in the house, just got to click cancel.
Yeah.
He looks off, and that's the brilliance of this performance. I think we're going to talk about this, the scene between him and his son. But the difference between what's on the page, which is quite beautifully written, but also I think this script is one of their more terse scripts. And the way that the actors fill in the gaps with their performances is amazing. Bill Macy's eyes, the way they catch light, the way that they're so bright, but also opaque. And he's like almost crying in a lot of scenes, or right on the edge, but still super sunny. Is just a triumph of screen acting. I can't,
you see the internal struggle. You see a guy putting on different kind of personas moment to moment. You see him like trying to put on a smile as a kind of armor to say the next thing that he has to say to try to get the next thing that he needs to get. And it hurts him like every time.
Do you think that he's one of these characters where you could, you like get to the bottom and you're like, there's nothing there. Like you could say that about his character.
That is revealed in the scene with the son. I think that's the most you ever see it.
Yeah. I just want to say that I think maybe the answer is to that question is no.
That there's nothing there?
No, I think that there is something there. I don't know what it is. Like, but.
Yeah, it's the guy in his tighty whities getting arrested. Exactly. I mean, that's what's there. It's a howling scream. You know, whatever it is, it's very raw and very unfixable.
But he is a character with human emotions. He's not just like a psychopath trying to...
He's not a cipher, no.
No, no.
He's like a sensitive guy in a lot of ways. He feels things quite sentimentally.
Yeah, when Marge says, I'm carrying quite a load here. He has this little smile he gives, like sort of to her stomach, essentially. It's like a quarter second, but it's just like you just see, like, in better times, this guy putting on a show at like a baby shower or something. It's like the social version of himself is so pathetic and so reflexive, but also like so there, you know,
to say hello to a baby in a belly. Yeah.
While you're like being interrogated by a cop.
His Wacky Jacks doodles that he's doing, that I love golf thing. That's the thing that William H. Macy was doing on set just to calm himself down for real. And Ethan Coen saw it and was like, that's insane. We need like an insert of this bizarre behavior.
I want the story to be that Deacon saw it. I was like, right. Look at this.
I'm saying the cops, they can advise us on this. I'm saying call a professional.
No. No cops. That's final. This is my deal here, Wade.
Yeah.
Jean is my wife here.
I gotta tell you, Wade, I'm leaning to Jerry's viewpoint here.
Well.
But we gotta protect Jean. We're not holding any cards here, Wade. They got them all, so they call the shots.
You're darn tootin'.
Damn it.
I'm telling you.
Well, why don't we... Stan, I'm thinking we should offer him $500,000.
Hey. Now, come on here. No way, Wade. No way.
We're not horse trading here, Wade.
Yeah.
We got to just bite the bullet on this thing.
Yeah.
Diner scene is amazing. Similarly, the stuff he's doing with his hands and that napkin is just watch the way Stan Grossman is holding the pie on the end of his fork, and then watch what William H. Macy is doing with his hands and the napkin, and you'll just see. Like the difference, Stan has a piece of pie on the end of that fork and he holds it and then puts it down. That's his blocking. William H. Macy is doing this like virtuosic creative hiding in the napkin. It's incredible.
When Stan takes his side and says, I got to say I'm with Jerry on this one. They're holding all the cards. Like Bill Macy as Jerry says, yeah, in a way like that's like just a little bit too enthusiastic, just a little bit too celebratory that things might be turning his way.
I feel like Will Ferrell based like a lot of his comedic persona off of William H. Macy. And like there must have been some kind of insight for him. He's like, I can be this kind of Midwestern guy and give this kind of weird, hostile, soft energy.
Wow. Oh, that's totally flipping my whole understanding of Will Ferrell's like not really his like SNL career, but his movie career, like the characters, like the Anchorman. Should we do a Will Ferrell, John C. Reilly movie as a bonus episode at some point?
Maybe. He's like William H. Macy, but with a beat you can dance to.
Yeah, but then when he does that, he overemphasizes like, yeah. And then there's a great little moment where Stan just gives him a look. He just gives him a look like, why are you at? There's something here about the way you're acting.
I think just in a little teacup version of it, the scene with the cashier is so short. But it's so what Macy's trying to do the entire film, where her energy is just radiant and so specific. And he kind of tries to build up steam to go from the tone of the conversation he was just having, where he was trying to match Stan and Wade. Yeah. And then she's coming with this like just unlimited, what do you call it?
I mean, I think there's a little bit of ennui behind her eyes too.
Like, you think she looks sad?
She looks tired, yeah. And she says, how was everything today?
Have you spent a lot of time in this part of the Midwest?
I have spent some time in Kansas.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say that I've encountered this type of person in any regard.
See, I feel like my family partially located in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And so spent a lot of time there in the 90s. And I just feel like she's dead on. There's a certain level of like, in the same way that people in New York are sometimes really into being from New York and having great New York energy. People from there sometimes just play it to the hilt. And that means like having that crazy quilting energy.
Yeah, there's quilting and then there's sewing.
She's coming in full hilt. He tries to muster a smile and kind of give her a genuine like Midwestern, I'm matching your tone. And when she smiles back at him, it's so glaring that it's like, how could you ever manage to keep up with these people? Mm. Seems to be what the scene is about to me.
So you think when he says, how are you? How about you? And then she gives him kind of like note, like a sort of weird expression.
She tilts her head and gives him this big, like huge smile back.
I don't know why I read that as sort of tired, like the sort of the exhaustion of that kind of service work where you have to put that kind of a performance on for every customer.
Right.
But it's possible I'm not fully keyed into what was happening. But I also just did want to point out that this is a scene where, somewhat as an afterthought, you can pick up on the fact that Jerry is screwing over the kidnappers because he asked for $1 million and he told them that he's going to give them 80. We find out that he actually asked for $1 million. Wade says, how about we just give him $500,000? Jerry kind of pitches a fit. He's like, no, no, no. And it's like, he still would have made off with 400 grand. You know what I'm saying?
We don't know how much trouble he's in.
Yeah. Clearly he's in a lot of trouble if he needs... Like he was trying to get, well, we kind of get a shape of it because he was trying to get $750 for the parking lot.
Yeah.
And he's trying to get $1 million from the ransom money. So he's playing with some real debt.
You think that he's basically been spending money as if he was successful, not telling anyone that he's like, he probably spent like 600 grand in the 90s without telling anyone.
I think they keep it so vague that I almost don't want to try to piece it together. Like, it doesn't feel like it's like profligate spending. It feels like maybe like a bad business deal that he didn't tell anybody about. Like maybe someone tricked him or he thought he could start like a gas station or something and it just completely fell through and he's just got a hole to fill. I would imagine it's less, yeah, like it's less like extravagance or exuberance and more just like a very large initial capital expenditure that he made on the sly and now is just like completely fucked and nobody knows about it.
Because the time to tell anyone about it would have been so long ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, then when Stan's outside, I feel like Stan asks like, and Scotty, is he going to be all right? And you can see on William H. Macy's face that he has completely forgot that his son is going to have any experience.
He forgot his son exists?
Yeah. This will leave a mark.
Yeah.
And that the uncertainty about what's going to happen to the mom is going to, like, you know, hit Scotty, who has no idea that this is set up, like, to save the day.
So the next scene is a powerhouse, a miniature. Next scene is a minimalist powerhouse scene between Tony Denman, who plays Scotty, and William H. Macy, the kid, and his dad. Like I said, very, very different from how it plays on the page versus how the characters kind of fill in the blanks. Production designer, too. I mean, I don't want to go too far into this, but like the accordion... The posters, like it's like
a, there's a Whitesnake poster and an Accordion King poster. So the kids at that point of adolescence where you can somehow hold the two in your mind.
He's a cool kid.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the three men that are stacked up, the three different generations, yeah, I relate to him the most.
Yeah.
His experience.
Yeah. And shout out to Ben for drawing this line in episode 9. Just like how they've made two movies in Minneapolis about fathers and sons and the differences between the different characterizations of Arthur Gopnik versus Jerry Lundegaard.
They're both like hiding secrets. They both have kind of a secret nervous experience of their own life. And then they then present who they are to their wives and children as much more stable and much more like the community works. I'm thriving in the community. Everything's okay. Is William H. Macy a protagonist in this film?
When you said unforgivable protagonist to me before we recorded the last episode, I said, well, you got to do Jerry. And you said he's not the protagonist. And
he's
then,
not.
And he's not. No, and I agreed with you. And I think that the reason that this movie is the one that hooks people so hard is they give you all the pleasures of a character who's that messed up and that unforgivable. And then 30 minutes in, they do like a sort of psycho-esque structural shift where we have this long pan across like painting supplies and we meet Marge and her husband who are just so good and have so much warmth to the way that they interact with each other. And so, you know, we get both. And then finally, we meet the protagonist of the film, which is Marge. But like, it's a structural high wire act that probably pays off better than any example of that I can think of, where you would delay introducing the protagonist for that long. But the relief, like the way that it's structured so that when the audience goes, ah, it's like getting yourself into like a perfect temperature bath to meet this character who's so capable, and she's got this unborn child that she's protecting, and she's got this husband who's so helpful. Got to save Marge for something else. Certainly not today's episode, but like, and it's been remarked upon before, but that's part of why this movie hit so hard is pulling that off so fluently.
Yeah, it really feels equally stacked. It feels like an ensemble film, and it feels like there's three main train tracks that are going through it. It's Marge, it's Steve Buscemi and Stormare, and it's William H. Macy. And all three of those camps want really different things and are having different experiences, getting information at different times. But each time that you switch over to one of them, I really feel like you start to experience the ups and downs, the setbacks, and the when they move forward with those characters. It's just that Marge is so much, like, talk about the McKee stuff, the center of good that we were talking about last week.
Exactly. She's
just such a pleasurably, like, idiosyncratic, like, very much like Twin Peaks, you know? It's like,
yes.
Seriously, it's just in this world where people are so scary, there's so much darkness, and just have this one character who's kind of, like, almost spiritually enlightened in their kind of, like, perception, hyper-perceptive and very open, just very open.
She has a love of life.
Open-hearted, but nothing is passing them by. Incredibly perceptive, yeah. Like they can see through things.
She's an Agent Cooper type.
Yeah.
And can I also say that like there's a slightly different calibrated version of this character who's like lived in this small town and like, or she's worked in this, because she's not in the Twin Cities. She's outside the Twin Cities. So there's a version of this character, I think legitimately, who's like never seen two people gunned down or a cop and who reacts way more like a loss of innocence.
Well, when she says, I think I'm going to barf, you think it's because the crime scene and then it's because she's pregnant.
Yeah, exactly. So we're emotionally with her. She has emotions. She's like a fully fleshed out character. But she's also has like a, she's tough. She's a tough cookie.
Not a distant parent.
No. She's going to be a great parent.
That's the thing.
And her husband is going to be a great father.
Right.
Like with all these other bad dads, we have a good mother to be and a good father to be with a baby to protect.
This three train track thing reminds me of No Country for Old Men too, where you have Tommy Lee Jones, you have Sugar, and you have Josh Brolin.
Yeah.
And you really do experience it from their, like when you switch over, you really do experience it from their POV. I think what the movies that we discussed last week are unique because there's just nowhere to go. The protagonist is your only protagonist and it's a fully stacked, irredeemable character. But if you just have some place that the audience can hop to, and it's Tommy Lee Jones, most likely, is like the true hero of that film, would you say?
Yeah.
I'm just saying that thing where you have three characters and they can be it's powerful.
How you doing there, Scotty?
Dad, what are they doing? What do you think they're doing with Mom?
It's okay, Scotty. They're not gonna want to hurt her any. These men, they just want money.
Yeah, well, what if something goes wrong, Dad?
No, no. Nothing's going wrong here. Granddad and I, we're making sure this gets handled right.
I really think we should call the cops here.
No, no. No one can know about this thing. We gotta play ball with these guys. Yes, Stan Grossman, he'll tell you the same thing.
Yeah, but Dad...
We're gonna get Mom back for you. But we gotta play ball. You know? That's the deal here. So if Lorraine calls, or Sylvia... You just say, Mom's down in Florida with Pearl and Marty.
The performance of the kid is totally pitted and very realistic. It's really heartbreaking. The way that William H. Macy smiles when he says, now if Lorraine calls, and he kind of pivots suddenly to being like, you know, Lorraine, Lorraine's nice, or whatever the smile, whatever that ingratiating smile is when he says that. And it's the same smile. He gives him the same smile right as he's closing the door. That's why I said, like, he puts on this armor to do the thing that it's like he's telling him what to do. He's telling his son how to lie to other people. And you see him, like, put on the smile before he does it. He's going to close the door and leave his son alone. You see him put on the smile before he does it. It's, but, you know, Macy is good enough that even a fake smile conveys something of real tenderness that's all strangled up. It's quite painful to watch.
Yeah, just the way he says Pearl and Marty. Yeah. Like, the way he says those names is, there's something beyond words that's so evocative about the way he says their names. That just it just reminds you of the same way I was saying, like, the way that he, like, regards Frances McDormand's pregnancy. It's like, it's the glad handing. It's the familiarity and the familial of his character that he wields. You know, he uses it as a weapon to get what he wants, to get the kid to act how he wants, even though the kid's, like, breaking down. And so in terms of, like, his parenting in this moment, I mean, he's not giving the kid anything. He just says, no, 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 we're not going to call the cops.
And also just, we're in control. The dads are in control. Your granddad and your dad are in control, and we're not going to let anything happen. And the kid goes, well, I feel like the police should be involved, which is, you know, the kid does not see them as the highest, like, you know, paternal authority. It's like, let's get the cops involved.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest threat.
That's the biggest threat to the plan.
Yeah. Because his son can't talk to anyone about it, because William H. Macy's going to give him nothing. His grandfather is a monster. He's just going to have to suffer through this entirely alone. And then his mom is going to die. Like, you just actually think about what Scotty's experience is going to be. Like, that's probably the last moment you want to hang out with him, is in the moment before he finds out that his mom dies and his dad's going to go to jail, and his dad basically killed his mom and caused his grand... I mean, he's going to... Okay, talk about orphans. Scotty's about to go down a rough road.
Fully, essentially orphaned by the actions of his father.
Yeah.
And also, they were making his life miserable before that, even when his dad knew he was pulling all this shit. Like, can you imagine being... like, it's really, like, low-key vicious, if you think about it. On top of everything else, I'm not going to let this kid play hockey.
Oh, yeah. That kind of disciplining by withholding, or how would you call that? Neglecting? What is that?
Withholding, yeah. Denial for no reason.
Or just even denial for a purpose.
Yeah.
That definitely seems like some of the gnarliest moments of parenthood. You're like, no, Jeremy, I'm taking this away now.
God.
Yeah, just the carrot and stick stuff that... It's interesting. It's like the first scene is the grandfather being like, you shouldn't even let him go to McDonald's. Got to be a hard ass on him. And then they're like, no, we're not as tough as you are. And then this scene is you see Jean trying to lay down the law a little bit. She's never as upset in the entire film as when he says fuck. That's like absolutely the top peak. I think even in the kidnapping scene, she's not quite as upset.
She's pretty upset. Language.
They're really offended. These people are really offended by bad language.
That man that shot you died in prison?
Angola. Yeah.
What'd you done? He'd been released.
Oh, I don't know. Nothing. Wouldn't be no point in it.
Kind of surprised to hear you say that.
Well, all the time you spend trying to get back what's been took from you, more is going out the door. After a while, you just have to try to get a tourniquet on it. Your granddad never asked me to sign on as a deputy. Loretta tells me you're quitting. How come you're doing that?
I don't know. I feel overmatched. I always figured when I got older, God would sort of come into my life somehow. And he didn't. And I don't blame him. If I was him, I'd have the same opinion of me that he does.
You don't know what he thinks.
Ed Tom Bell, not a father.
No kids?
I don't believe so. But he has a very complicated relationship with his own father, for sure.
And a long line of fathers, right? Because they all had the same job. Isn't that the opening?
Yeah. He didn't marry into it. He was born into it. And I have to say, I did not remember how many different twists and turns this conversation takes, because the big part about it is your wife keeps up a correspondence. I don't see you very often. You look older and you've been distant with me and I hear you're quitting. Why are you doing that? And then Tommy Lee Jones says, he changes the subject to coffee. He's essentially like sniping at his brother for the state of the house that he lives in. And his brother's giving him grief for abandoning his post as like a protector of the community. And important to note also that his brother's a wheelchair user. He was shot by someone and who died in prison. So it's a hard scene between them. They have a conversation that when I watched it, reminded me of conversations that I've had with my parents, asking them about relative older generations, being like, what happened to your grandfather? What happened to your grandmother? Like, where did they come from? How did they die? And, you know, the subtext of those conversations is sort of trying to fill in some of those blanks when you sometimes think about not being able to ask those questions in the future. Essentially, his brother says, you're not going to be able to protect yourself, even if you quit your job. You're still good. You know, you can't stop what's coming. That's vanity to think that you can. Okay, so one thing I would say about this scene is it's pure theme, right? Like, it's just character stuff. The crux of the plot. He's not Llewellyn's been killed. Shiger is, he has no leads that he's following. He's just checking in with his brother. I just think it's interesting that this extended sequence is just pure theme, right? It's just like enriching the idea of mortality and sort of the fraying bonds between people. But maybe this is kind of like the setup episode where I thought things were digressive and they weren't. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, it feels like a detective scene. You know, it feels like he's going in to find another lead, but it's just a personal scene. And it's just beautifully, all the character stuff with Ellis is amazing, where he goes, how have you been? And he goes, you're looking at it. And then I feel like that kind of gives the audience a cue to kind of just look around the room and get an understanding of, there's so much backstory to this character that's just from the set dressing. It's like really incredible.
Yeah.
It's a very calm scene, but it's got this kind of, the guy's living in a kind of chaotic and self-destructive way. He's kind of, in some way, he's treating himself very badly. There's like pills and booze bottles and like flypaper and little portrait of JFK and like
cats everywhere
and like tears in the mosquito netting. It's not like total hoarder, everything's a mess, but the guy is the second scene where you see the inside of Tommy Lee Jones's house is very, very clean.
Very
everything's
different.
Dustless. And this is a rugged space. He's with his rugged brother, who I guess both of them followed in their dad's footsteps, and his brother got shot a long time ago.
Yeah.
And Tommy Lee Jones is coming and saying, I mean, these are lines I went and read the part of the book that this is based off of, and a lot of it is word for word what they say in the book, but the line where he says, I feel overmatched, that's in the script. And
what a line reading.
Well, for sure.
The way he says I feel overmatched is maybe the most vulnerable we see Tommy Lee Jones.
Well, just think, if he didn't say it out loud, I mean, it's the most that he just admits, like, I feel weak.
He's fragile.
Yeah.
And his brother's basically just giving him such a hard time for retiring at a very advanced age for a police officer.
Well, that's because his brother had to leave when he got shot. Leave. And yeah. They're telling a story about a guy who just got killed. You know, it's like you leave when you get taken out. You don't walk away. Also not in the book. You can't stop what's coming. Not in the book. That's vanity. Not in the book. All those lines. All the really like a lot of the other stuff is word for word the way it is in the book. But I feel like when they did the adaptation, they took the general sub. The scene's also a lot longer in the book, so it's more time for subtext to develop. But I feel like the Coens really added these
hinge points,
incredibly iconic hinge points. Like, yeah. These are big lines and
I feel overmatched.
And also just the part where he says, "This country is hard on people." It's like you. A part of you is like, "Is he going to say the title of the movie next?" He's like, "This country is hard on people." Dot dot dot.
Yeah.
This is no country for old men. But he doesn't do it. It's like in the moment where you think he's about to say it, then he says, "You can't stop what's coming," which is really just like that is what's scary about Tommy Lee Jones contemplating his death at the end, telling the story about the fire and the horn. And what's scary about Sugar is just the like maybe you can stop Sugar, maybe Sugar doesn't get you, but something very much like Sugar is going to get everyone, no matter how much you try to protect yourself or take yourself off the field before you're overmatched.
Yeah. Or protect your family.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that next scene between Tommy Lee Jones and his wife. So Tommy Lee Jones shares his dreams with his wife. Ed Tom Bell tells us about a dream he had. He says he had two dreams about his father. First one is going to go ask him downtown about some money. Not interesting.
To him.
It's the briefest of descriptions. I had to go downtown to see about some money. The next dream is him in old timey times. He's following his father on horseback, and his father's got a horn with white flames in it, like they had in old times, which is an interesting thing. He just says, how does it end?
The first story that he tells, the first thing he says is that, you know, it's a dream about his dad, but his dad died when he was younger. The dream is about his dad at the age his dad was when he died. So, I mean, it makes me think of the Josh Brolin character, the relationship between the two of them, because he's basically talking about a ghost that's a guy about Brolin's age.
Yeah.
Yeah, the first story is he meets him in town, his dad gives him some money and he loses it, which I think is poetic. It's just that basic feeling of it's one of those like unplaceable dream things where somehow I've let someone down, but I don't really remember what I did or how I, you know, just that it sets the tone for the next dream. And I think the two are interwoven because both are, I can't keep up with my dad or I can't do what my dad wants me to do, what he's hoping I can do for him.
His dad is stronger than he is. By dying younger than him, his dad will always be more able than he is now.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting, I never put that together before. But yeah, he feels like Tommy Lee Jones is this old guy. He looks like a mountain. You know, he's really craggy. He's really authentic. And he's haunted by the ghost of this younger guy who hasn't lived through as much stuff as he has.
But yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting about that is it gives us access to this sort of flowy fantasy interior life of this hard-nosed cop character. Like his conception of like what old-timey, like about what the olden days were like and the sort of, I don't know, I imagine this being like some kind of like Norse myth or something, like a Viking myth with a horn. You know, it's giving you access to a side of his personality that we haven't seen before. Yeah, the relationship between him and his dad, which is, you know, profoundly distant because it's the distance is 20 years of him. His father died young. You can see something about the way that he was raised by his father by the previous scene and the way that the two brothers talk to each other. And then this dream description that he gives that ends the movie about going to meet his dad eventually somewhere in the hereafter. For a movie that's so, like Fargo, we were saying, it simulates reality. It's ending the movie on a poetic and hyper-real note, like a dreamlike kind of reverie or something that Tommy Lee Jones doesn't completely understand, so he's talking to his wife about it.
Okay, it's a whole like barren, dangerous landscape. The two oldest guys in the script, Tommy Lee Jones and his brother Ellis, are descendants of like a long line of lawmen in this land from when it was totally wild to where it is right now. They don't have kids. Ellis got injured out of the service. Tommy Lee Jones is now quitting because he feels like he's outmatched and it's coming. And that's the end. That's the end of that line. But the two guys, it's like they should be the dads. They are like the patriarchs. They're the like the people who should be holding the thing together. Tommy Lee Jones cannot save Josh Brolin, kind of surrogate son, surrogate ghost dad kind of figure for him.
Mm-hmm.
Tommy Lee Jones looks so scared in the last moments of this movie. The sound is a clock. It's like tick, 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 tick. And it ends with him just nervously looking down. He's looking at his wife, and then he like looks down, and it cuts to black. And he's really scared. It's really like he's in this quiet, safe, like antiseptic room with nothing but time to kill. And he's in as much danger as any of the other characters were when this kind of stalking serial killer was just steadily moving towards them.
He has a wife who's there to listen to him, but he doesn't have a father. He doesn't have a protector.
He has a memory. Both him and his brother are very much like living in the wake of the memory of their dad and the dad before them. And this whole kind of code.
But remember also where he says, I thought at a certain point God would reveal himself to me. And he didn't.
Tommy Lee Jones says that in the nicest sing-song way. He says, I always thought when I got older, God would sort of come into my life.
Did they write it phonetically?
No. He puts the spin on it. But he really says my life and God. And he also says fire really intense.
And then he says, I don't blame him. So he's judging himself.
I mean, I don't know what to say about this. The image of his dad with this fire in the horn is like magical. The description of it glowing like the moon. I don't exactly know what kind of animal horn you keep a fire in, but
I don't either.
It's so poetic. It really is just Tommy Lee Jones ending the film on just this like poetic reading. But he does it with so much fear in his face that I think it's a really interesting note to end this film that's been so gravelly and so kind of raw. On a scene of this guy whose face is so weathered, but his clothes are so clean, the wallpaper and the table are so clean, and he's just speaking at length so poetically, and the subtext of it is, even though I'm in this room and the movie's over and I'm safe, the real terror is steadily moving towards me.
I just want to relate it back to the scene we read also, just the way that the father figure and the fire are so comforting in a way, just to look at and be around, especially after having been out in the cold. But also there's like oceans of removal in terms of like where the father chose to live, what kind of house the father chooses to keep, and how the father conducts himself that like keeps the kid at arm's length, to say the least. It just seems like a very, very similar character dynamic on, you know, in some way.
Yeah, to try to be a child in the wake of a dude that lives like this is like you're going to come out so strangely shaped.
To be the son of Ethan Hawke and the Northman. I keep thinking about the Northman. Every time he describes that scene, I think about a scene from the Northman. Good movie.
Taking off, Pop. Won't see you for a while. Shipping out. Try something new. I need something old.
So we've talked about Lewin as this character who performs for people and very often gets very little, gets nothing back. And this scene's a fake out. So this is the scene where Lewin goes to visit his dad at a assisted living facility. And we see that paraphernalia in a little display case that says Mr. Hugh Davis, photos and pins and a mug and like something that looks like it might be a military hat, or maybe it's just related to the Merchant Marines.
Is this box of personal artifacts like when you move into the assisted living facility, basically you get rid of a bunch of stuff, but you get to keep some of it? And they put a little box outside of everyone's room to be like, this is the person who's inside here?
I think it's to help the dad remember who he is. I think this is to be like, this is you. This is your life.
Because the dad is not totally there.
I mean, he has totally, he has Alzheimer's or senility. Lewin plays for his father a beautiful rendition of, what does it say?
Shoals of Heron.
He says he...
Shoals of Herring, sorry.
Shoals of Herring. Oh, I thought it was Heron like the bird. No, Shoals
I thought
of,
it was Heron like the bird too, yeah, but it's no, Herring like the fish.
Shoals of Herring.
Makes more sense.
Yeah. He caught a million fishes. And yeah, again, this is a character who often performs to characters who are, except for the opening scene and maybe the scene at the end, he often performs to characters who are asleep or we think they're listening intently, but then they don't see a lot of money there. And in this case, he's performing for his father and you kind of feel like you might be getting through to him. And then the end of the scene, kind of a vicious punchline from the Coens, is that his dad just shit himself. And that's the reveal when he kind of runs down the hall and says he needs to be cleaned.
It's definitely a mirror to the Bud Grossman scene in like the biggest way, just with the shot language, the moving in, the deliberate miscues to make you think that the gatekeeper, the father figure, the patriarch is being moved and then yeah. You're misreading it.
Also similar to the poem we read last week too.
Seriously, and to just the feeling of whether it's Muldrow walking in with the frostbitten hands, you know, Jerry trying to make a plea to his father-in-law. It's always the like a character tries to present themselves as saying, like, according to your rules, sir, here's the situation I'm in.
Here's what I'm bringing you.
Here's what I'm bringing you. Here's where I'm at. And what they get is nothing. So you approach someone with some sense of making some plea.
He says, okay, here's this. You used to like this.
Yeah.
He saw the memorabilia in the case. He thought to himself, I'll play this song that you used to like. Maybe you'll hear it. And he didn't hear it. Or if he did hear it, he had no response. It's the ultimate distant father figure. And that's why I chose this.
No, he shits on him. I don't think it's just a passive shitting of the pants. I think it's an actual...
You think it's an active shit?
Yeah, I do. I think it's like
I shit on this.
It's a wordless review.
Shit sandwich.
I looked at the pages and the way the dad looks away and looks back is described in the pages. What's not in the pages is the way he closes his eyes and opens his eyes, which I think if you watch it, you can really see the exact moment that he starts to poop. I really think so.
Okay. Slightly more positive read. The music soothed him and it allowed him to let go something he was holding on to.
Yeah, I guess it could go either way. I really genuinely believe you could read it both ways, but in the experience that Lewin is having and that the audience is having, I think it's a letdown.
Lewin right? did not get a lot out of it.
Right. And so I think that's what makes this is the first scene that came to my mind, right? With the when you read the pages, is that what you said? This is the first one.
This was the first scene that came right. to mind.
It's the dad from To the White Sea. They wrote the dad from To the White Sea into Lewin Davis.
It's wordless.
It's you go there. There's this. You bear some part, whether it's the song you're singing or it's your frostbitten hands, and you get nothing. Just get nothing. Okay, so you chose the subject, the prison this week is distant fathers. Distant father figures?
Yeah.
Subject this week you chose is distant father figures. Were there any non-distant father figures available?
Norm, Marge's husband.
Norm has great promise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Beautiful performance from
John Carroll Lynch.
John Carroll Lynch. Let's see some sweet roles from him. Again, who else? Who's good?
This is why I'm asking you, because I figure you did a rundown of dads. Do you see anything okay. worth holding on to?
Albert Finney in Miller's Crossing is not distant.
Oh, just as a father figure
as
to Tom?
As a father figure to Tom, he behaves differently. He's more like, I need you, son.
Okay.
Oh, of course. What about Raising Arizona? They love that baby.
That's funny.
They love that baby. They want those hug. They got. He needs his huggies.
That film ends with a dream too.
Yeah, a dream of loving family all together. Have I told you my theory that that will come true?
Which part?
That the ending of that movie will come true.
Every part of the vision.
Every part of the vision will become true because every time that what's his name? The character.
High.
Yeah. Every time that High has a vision of like the evil guy, the evil guy comes out and becomes real. He has a dream of that guy and that guy becomes real. So I like to think that he has the ability to dream the future into existence and that that is actually going to happen. And then that's the surprising thing about that movie is maybe he does have, maybe they do have good days ahead of them.
Yeah. Yeah. His visions are prophecy.
I like to read it as a truly optimistic note as opposed to just deeply ironic.
Also, just similar to the Ed Tom Bell, Lewin, this whole sequence is about him trying to pick up his dad's line of work again. You know, and when the guy's like, are you Hugh's kid? He's like, you're not, what does he say? You're not Hugh Davis's kid. He goes, why not?
Why not?
Yeah, it's like, because Lewin is so, I mean, the subtext of him singing the song, it's like, everyone's like, you're not an artist. You're a merchant marine. You're like a working class guy. You know, like you don't have the disposable income to do this crap.
And he tries to pick it back up. Truly his fault. He told his sister to throw out all that crap in an earlier scene.
It's a scene about a guy trying to like fall into his dad's groove, like do the job that his dad did for his entire life. And they're different people.
Do you think he says, I'm doing something new, something old. Do you think, I mean, I'd love to see a flashback of Lewin Davis trying to do merchant marine work. I would imagine it would be a lot like a slightly different version of Joaquin Phoenix in The Master.
Yeah.
On one of those ships.
Yeah, it's like The Master, except he's just more like throwing tanties and like kind of sitting in the corner by himself.
Yeah, less physical altercations, more just like a lot of unpleasant interactions.
Yeah, just introverted simmering.
Maybe playing a little music.
Yeah.
Picking up some shanties.
What do you do for the recreation?
Oh, the usual. Bowl, drive around, the occasional acid flashback. Do you think he, was that yoga?
It increases the chances of conception.
Increases?
Well, yes. What did you think this was all about? Fun and games? I want a child.
Okay, yeah. Okay, but let me explain something about the dude.
Look, Jeffrey, I don't want a partner. In fact, I don't want the father to be someone I have to see socially or who have any interest in raising the child himself.
Oh, so that doctor,
Exactly. Now, what happened to your face? Did Jackie Treehorn do that as well?
No, it was the chief of police of Malibu, real reactionary. So your father... Oh, yeah, I get it. Yeah.
What?
Oh, man, my thinking about this case had become very uptight. Yeah. Your father.
Final scene I chose for Distant Fathers. Big Lebowski. He notices she's doing this, like, kind of butterfly bend under the blankets. He says, is that yoga? And she says, it increases the chances of conception. Get a true spit take. Increases. And he says, let me explain something to you about the dude. She says, no, I want a child, but I'm not interested in anyone who has any interest in raising it. And this is the thing that I am just so interested by that I had never really clocked before because there's so much else going on in the movie is like how quickly he just moves on to another subject. Like no reflection, no misgivings, just like, oh, okay, yeah, that's cool. But then he just keeps saying, and then he realizes like, oh, I've been so uptight about this case. I just realized your father doesn't have any money. He keeps saying your father. And it's a big turning point for the movie. But like, that's his experience of finding out he's going to be a dad. Just like, unreal. He is so ready to let go of that. And I just, and you know, we have like a father at the end of his life. We have fathers at different stages in their life, and I just wanted to include that because those two are going to fuck this kid up.
Well, he's not going to know this kid, right? Isn't that, well, what does she say?
Exactly? You think he's not going to know the kid?
She has picked him for this reason.
Yeah, I mean, typically when you like do a sort of single parent by choice.
I don't want a partner. In fact, I don't want the father to be someone I have to see socially or who will have any interest in rearing the child himself.
But it was a non-consensual sperm donation. I don't know. I think it's amazing that he just moves past this.
Well, do we know if the dude has other kids?
I think he does not.
He probably does not.
Let me explain something to you about the dude.
I just want to know what he's about to say. That's my number. I want to know in this movie when Jesus knocks on the door and he has to go tell all his neighbors that he has a record, a pederast, you know? They cut right as he's taking in air to say his opening sentence. I want to know what Jesus says in this. I want to know what the dude is going to tell her about the dude.
To me, it's pretty obvious. He's going to be like, I don't knock ladies up.
In both cases, it being unsaid leaves it so much funnier in my head than anything they could possibly write. But them gathering themselves to correct, it's a little bit like William H. Macy putting on the mask. It's just that transition before you're like, you see someone who's like, they're thinking transactionally, but their face is not keeping up with their mind. So you see the effort, you know?
Yeah. And look, I'm not trying to make a moral case against like sperm donors, but those arrangements are typically made like with some sort of a conversation or some, you know, full knowledge. I just think the way he reacts is fascinating. And so, you know, the fact that they set it up with him talking about like him doing almost nothing his whole life, or not almost nothing, but.
Well, she says she only starts to do the butterfly move after he's told her all this stuff about himself. I feel like that's the interview.
Oh, so that's the interview. And she's like, yep, he's checked out.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's make this happen.
Seriously. No, I think it's stuff like that.
I never noticed that as a turning point. I think
you can track the moment that Lewin's dad starts pooping. And I think you can track when she's like, okay, I got what I need. Like.
Incredible.
The Metallica thing is that is as much as, you know, like Jeff Bridges has been in the news recently talking about the Big Lebowski sequel. The prequel where he's a roadie for Metallica on the Sound of Speed tour and thinks that they're assholes. It's pretty good.
I think that the sequel has to be young Jeff Bridges.
It's Godfather.
It's Godfather 2. It's young Jeff Bridges as the roadie, intercut with Little Lebowski.
We talked about it. It's in 2016 and Little Lebowski's 25.
Yeah. Well, it would basically be 6 years prior to whenever the movie's produced, so that Jeff Bridges' age is more or less in line.
Yeah.
Little Lebowski.
He's talking about it. He's out there.
Who's talking about it?
Jeff Bridges.
He says he wants to do a Lebowski sequel?
Yeah.
Wow. I don't know. Maybe there's not that much here. I just... to me, I thought it was a fascinating note to end on because it's just it's the moment where a guy realizes he's going to be a dad or he realizes he is going to have offspring, and without much pomp and circumstance.
Oh, I have a good dad.
Yeah.
But a distant dad. George Clooney, you know, Brother Where Art Thou? That's like the big hook at the end.
Right.
He just wants to see his daughters again.
Right. He's physically distant because of the incarceration.
Yeah.
But he's totally motivated by the children that he wants to see again. Yeah.
Yeah. Because before I was like, the reason why this Lebowski thing fits in is this is a landscape of dads who don't really give a shit. Like the fact that they have kids like emerge from their lives is not a conscious choice. It's not a thing they seem super invested in. So it would make sense that there's no scene in a film where someone finds out that they're going to be a father and is like moved to tears. This is the version of that.
Yeah.
But I could say Norm, good dad, possibly, and George Clooney, maybe if he gets his act together,
yeah,
potentially good dad. Hi.
Hi.
Potentially good dad, though like, you know, all these guys.
Goes about it in a bit of a,
yeah,
a kind of a Maude Lebowski type scheme.
But at least they want it, you know?
Yeah.
At least like Norm and George Clooney and High, they have a desire to be there, even if they're, if even if they're fucking it up like crazy.
Can I say also that there's another distant father in this scene, which is Jeffrey Lebowski, the big Lebowski, her father is, Maude's father is completely distant.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't it kind of interesting that she's sleeping with somebody who has the same name as her father?
It's very strange, isn't it? That's her name too.
It's her name too. She's like, the kid's name is going to be Lebowski twice. It's not a maiden name.
It's a hyphenate.
Lebowski, Lebowski. Yeah. Yeah. That's what it should be called. Lebowski, Lebowski.
What about Pappy O'Daniel? Good dad?
No.
No?
Totally self-serving.
Okay, so what is the point? Do you, just as filmmakers, what do you think that they're laying out here? Like, why this? And also, just bringing back to the White Sea, why do you think that, like, we needed to know this about Muldrow's dad right now, at this point in the story, before, like, when we cut out of the present and we go back, we see this thing with the dogs, and then we see this thing with the dad. Like, how does this work in this movie? How does this work in other films? Because who your dad is kind of an insight to, like, why you have the defense mechanisms and why you have the survival skills that you have, right?
I think it's an interesting dramatic choice. If you want to make it super dry, just like characters who didn't get that fulfillment tend to be really interesting, fucked up people, or at least in these stories they are. Like, you can see in Muldrow's behavior how that affected him. Like, you can see, like, there's a reason we have this flashback. It's to show us some insight without words that that gives us something to hold on to.
If you grew up in a way that was, like, overwhelmingly neglected in a way that an audience can understand just from observing it, then that gives you this kind of hand-to-mouth, live-wire, moment-to-moment energy that they're very interested in.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that Lewin and Muldrow have the same dad because, you know, I mean, like, I realized, like, last night, I was like, I think Lewin's totally homeless.
Yeah.
Right? Like, he doesn't have an apartment.
That's the Gorfines. They say, we're last on his list, but, like, once he's run through the rest of his Rolodex, he comes here.
Yeah. But Lewin is really, like, I mean, we haven't read all the Two White Sea, but, you know, it's like, it's a movie where a guy goes to sleep and wakes up. You know, and there's no, like, long ellipses. It's just a guy. It's like a homeless guy figuring out, like, where am I going to sleep tonight? Where am I going to get the food? How much money do I have? How do I get here? And what he's trying to do is survive and, you know, stay being an artist. But he's in enemy territory or something.
Yeah.
He's in a completely hostile landscape.
He can't stay at his sister's place.
It's as ill-fitting as the Gorfines.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's not his home.
And he also learns that he learns earlier in the movie that he's not going to get the family house because it pays for his dad's upkeep. So, like, he thought he had a little bit of some kind of a nest egg that was going to be split between his sister and him. He's not going to. Is his sister a single mom, by the way?
I don't know.
Seems like it. Absent father for his nephew.
But can we just bring it back? Like, what these points, when they happen in the story, the things that they let you know, like in Fargo, right? It really lets you know the relationship between William H. Macy and his father-in-law really lets you know, like, this is the hinge. This is the hinge. The whole story is gonna build out of this thing where he looks to his father-in-law and goes, if you take care of me, you're taking care of the three of us. And the guy says, I will let you plummet. You know, and that's the desperation that sets William H. Macy to go looking for that security in all these other places and set all this chaos in motion.
That wall that William H. Macy puts up with his son and that his father-in-law puts up with him, those are the walls that have to be kind of hopped over and surmounted, or those are the walls that cause people to behave so dysfunctionally because they can't go in those directions.
Yeah. And then, okay, so in
so then it leads people to do these crazy behaviors, these heists, and these, they go outside of the boundaries of social mores because the social mores are not cohesive.
Yeah, and I think you see, like, if you hold off, you know, it's like when you reveal stuff about people's parents, you really get what makes them unsatisfiable. And it's like, you know, you don't know exactly know what drives Tommy Lee Jones, but when you find out that his brother thinks that he's quitting unless he gets shot, you know, or dies like in the field, and he's having this dream that haunts him about his dad just moving ahead of him, you know, him not being able to keep up with his dad. It's like, yeah, you really understand the guy. You really understand what's been behind his eyes and his choices earlier in the film. Okay, so like this Tommy Lee Jones stuff happens at the end of the movie. These reveals, right?
Yeah.
This Fargo stuff happens at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
And the Llewellyn, the Llewyn Davis stuff happens at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
The placement in To the White Sea. Remember I asked you that?
Like, yeah.
Why do you need to know about dad at this point? Like, why in Fargo and To the White Sea do you need to know this stuff early? But then the other films you find out like in the last quarter of the film, basically.
It's good to know things about characters at the beginning. It's good for there to be mystery about characters' backstory. It's also good to have a backstory at the beginning, depending on the needs of the story. I mean, I hate to be so broad about that, but it's just like the stories function differently as a result of whether you get that information early or late or how you get it. Do you get it through words? Do you get it through a flashback, a nonverbal flashback? Do you get it through talking to kidnappers you're hiring and revealing your mishigas in like a therapy session that you're like didn't plan on having with the people you're hiring to kidnap your wife? Like, it's exposition, right? All the stuff we're talking about is exposition. Like, really, this whole episode is about exposition because it's like, how did you get here?
I'm asking these questions because I'm trying to get this on the record, because you picked a topic that's going to pay off later. This is setting up stuff that this is not just a random scene. Mm-hmm. It's like clearly because of its placement in the script. They're teeing up something. So I'm just curious to see, now that we know this about Muldrow, what do you take forward into the scene where he's hanging from the parachute and the following scenes? How has he changed now that you know this?
I feel bad for him more.
Okay.
For one thing, you know, I have more sympathy for him.
Yeah.
Which I think is important. And also, like,
is this a save the cat kind of thing?
Has he become the cat?
I'm just saying, like, when you, like, just the inclusion of the, like, his dad doesn't care about him.
Yeah.
Does that make you like a character?
Yeah. It's a good question. I think it does for me. So it's a good question. I will just say that, like, I was wrong about there not being a flashback. And I think the fact that the movie did this extended passage for us took place over weeks, you know, for the movie viewing audience would be like a not insignificant amount of time. Like we've said, like there aren't long flashbacks in their movies. So, I mean, for one thing, it just makes me really excited about where this is going to go, because it makes me feel like the film could open up and kind of blossom in ways that I'm not expecting. Because
Other flashbacks.
Could be other flashbacks or just other things that the movie does that I have no idea it's going to do. You know what I'm saying? Like, we started this script and I was like, it's meticulous montages. It's dialogue free. This is just going to be process, you know? And then basically with this flashback scene that's sort of, you know, that started in episode 9 and now ended in episode 12. I feel like we got the dream sequence. We got the dream description from Ed Tom Bell that happened at the end of that movie. We kind of got that at the beginning here.
That's why I'm super, like, because right now you're saying as an audience member, now you have like a bigger appetite because you're like, oh my God, they might put anything on the table.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're in that. It's interesting to me, like when you're watching a film, those moments when you kind of relax and go like, wow, I'm really, really open. I'm in a pleasurable state of engagement and anticipation.
And it held the tension in a way that is very atypical.
Yeah.
But super interesting. Like the guy's free falling, literally free falling. And we cut to a flashback. And so the tension was, what's happening to this guy in the present? And then what's happening to this guy in the past, which suddenly feels so present.
See, and what I'm curious is, like, up until now, he's been cool, he's been effective, and he's been, like, cunning. Like, when he, like, shoots the gun in the darkness, I feel like that's the part that's, like, the most likable, actually, because it's so kind of mystical the way he does it. But it's still, he's murdering a bunch of people, so it's not that likable.
His heroism got undercut, like, a minute later, too, by the plane getting...
But it's really like 20 minutes into the movie, like, as he's falling through the air, they just need to cut to a flashback that ultimately... like as gnarly as that scene is where he kills the dog, this is the first time that you really like him. Is, I mean, we just talked about the kill the dog time, scene, and the kill the dog scene is followed by like the save the cat scene, because you're just like, well, his dad is really outstandingly mean.
It's like what Blake Snyder was saying is, if you've got a son of a bitch, you make everyone around him seem worse.
The son of a bitch has arrived, and it's the dad.
Yeah,
living on that cliff by the ocean, in the northmost part of Alaska.
Yeah, this is the home that birthed him.
How much more distant can your father be when he literally lives at the greatest distance from all other human beings, but then brings you with him? It's very confusing. Yeah, that's also confusing. Like, why would you want to be a dad if you just want to be away from everyone and you don't care about your son? Why?
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 These are the questions we ask ourselves when we're flying through a story that we don't know where it's going to go.
When you find yourself hurtling through the abyss, you start thinking about, like, don't think my dad really cared that I was hurt.
I heard someone told me that they read that military people with PTSD, oftentimes their PTSD is actually revealing a lot of childhood trauma on top of the, or underneath the war experiences that they had.
Yeah, well, there would be interlocking traumas.
Yeah. Shall we leave it there? Intense episode, but I really feel good about what we covered too.
Yeah, do you have just one big takeaway from it?
No, I'm just gonna be distant.
Yeah,
I'm not gonna give you anything. see how that resonates.
Don't you feel like I've done everything? I did everything that I could do to make you happy, and still, you don't want to give it to me.
I don't know, Ray. I don't know what I can give you. I'm sorry. I don't have more. That was To the White Sea, episode 12.
Pages 23 and 24. Come back next week to see how Muldrow deals with being suspended by a parachute off of a gantry in a port in Tokyo as it's on fire.
Let's leave all these weepy emotions behind and just focus on the physical action. Or not. I don't know. I don't know what it's going to be.
I'm going to go to Canal Plastics and buy some Mylar.
Hell yeah. Plastics. My poor heart is sentimental. Not me. To the White Sea is produced by Jordan Fish and Ray Tintori.
Starring Griffin Newman as Lieutenant Muldrow.
Production support provided by Ben Hosley and Ike Sreeskandarajah.
To the White Sea theme music written and performed by Dan Romer.